Thank you so much for tuning in to the How We Rise Leadership Podcast, where we are redefining leadership and helping you step into the leader that both your destiny and humanity is calling you to lead and to thrive as a whole life leader and to lead all areas of your life well. If you are not currently subscribed to our podcast, whether or not you listen to them on iTunes or Spotify, please click subscribe so you can get alerts on new episodes. Typically, we drop new episodes on Wednesdays, and that way you can get alerts. If this podcast is supporting you, we would love for you to leave a comment, which then helps us get our message out there to more people. And the last thing is I want to gift you with a chapter from my book, This Is How We Rise. It's the resilience chapter, and it really has all these amazing tools to help you turn obstacles into opportunities and to help you reframe around challenges. So you can subscribe for our newsletter at shesummit.com. That is shesummit.com. Sign up for our newsletter and you will get a free chapter of our book. And again, thank you so much for being part of our She Summit community and the How We Rise community. I'm just so excited about introducing this guest. We've had so many incredible guests that have such diverse backgrounds, but I'm so excited because we're going to be talking about how we rise as socially responsible companies through COVID-19 and just being responsible and better companies, right? And how do we lead well in companies to make that impact? And her name is Catherine Hernandez Blades. She is our guest today. Catherine is the SVP and Chief ESG and Communications Officer at Fortune 150, the insurance powerhouse Aflac. She's a communications, marketing, public and government affairs and crisis management executive with more than 25 years of professional experience, including a decade in the C-suite of Fortune 500 companies. She's served in the CMO and CCO roles simultaneously at two Fortune 500 companies, Aflac and Flex. She's been honored to be in the inaugural class of Women in Communications Hall of Fame, a PR News Hall of Famer, Forbes Top 50 Most Influential Global CMO, and the list goes on. So Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on today's call.
Thanks, Claudia. It's an honor to be here. I love this organization. I love the mission. And thank all of you for joining us today. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, yes. So the first thing that I want to do is, you know, especially we have all level executives. We have, you know, a lot of like mid-manager levels to senior level folks on these calls, as well as folks in transition. And I think that the number one thing is I'd love to hear your career journey and like what led to your work in social responsibility, communications, like through the corporate ranks. And obviously, you know, that also led you into those leadership teams.
I am the perfect example of what not to do when curating a career. So take all of this with a grain of salt. I have been very, very lucky. Growing up, all I ever wanted to be was a broadcast journalist. So at 19, taking 21 hours a semester on a full ride scholarship, I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go produce a show in Lafayette, Louisiana called Good Morning Acadiana. And after a couple of years of doing that, I determined that maybe this wasn't for me. And so I transitioned into corporate PR. I have worked for 5 public companies in positions of increasing responsibility. All of the companies I've worked for have been in highly regulated industries, and they've also had a very large international footprint. So I also, in curating my career, spent some time in Silicon Valley as a CMCO, but many years before that, I was a very young gubernatorial appointee in the state of Louisiana, and I ran the Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board, which seafood, that industry in Louisiana is a $2 billion a year industry, wow. And that was 20 plus years ago. So in curating my career, I was very, very fortunate not just to get the international and the public company experience, but to also spend time in Silicon Valley as well as in government, which sort of set up the launching pad for what I'm able to do now in terms of corporate affairs and corporate social responsibility and those sorts of things.
Did you always, was getting into the C-suite and that drive, because I feel like you have to have a certain level of drive, right, to continue to move up. And you know, very few people make it and break that glass ceiling. So what was sort of unique about, was it like a fire and a passion or a vision that you just had, you know, that drove that? What unleashed that in you?
Well, a great deal of stubbornness, because the one thing I didn't mention was I'm from a small town in Louisiana, and you have those formative moments. I remember I was going away to college, so proud, first person in my family to go to college, full ride scholarship. And my mother took me to visit her best friend, and her husband was there so that I could say goodbye before I left for school. And I remember he told me that a college education on a woman was a waste. All it would teach me how to do would be to put on a diaper with finesse.
Wow.
And he meant it. So I knew at that moment, I was not coming home. You know, I was going to prove people wrong. The other thing I didn't mention was I spent 10 years in aerospace and defense.
Lockheed Martin, there, I see.
Yes, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. Very heavily male dominated, particularly back in those days, industries. And I can remember being told everything from, gosh, there are so many stories. I'll give you one. I was in the Netherlands and I was there for a strategic planning meeting. My purse had gotten stolen on the train between Amsterdam and The Hague. I was terribly jet lagged and I was, you know, armed for bear, as they say here in the South. And I remember going into this meeting and being totally ignored. There were two women in the meeting. I was one of the two. They were all men sitting around the table. And the gentleman who was facilitating the meeting, I kept trying to break in and break in. And we were doing an exercise called stakeholder mapping and creating a decision tree and looking at members of the government in the Netherlands, what their hot buttons were, how we could hopefully persuade them that our own arms program would be better than another country's and the whole thing. And I kept trying to get his attention because I had something very, very important to say. And he just ignored me, completely ignored me, until I finally just blurted it out. Hey, that's the guy who went on record in the media as being against this program first. We have got to give him a graceful exit in the court of public opinion and in the media. Otherwise, this isn't going anywhere. He's just going to bear down and fight us the whole way. And he looked at me and he said, "That's what you've been wanting to say?" I said, "Yes." He said, "That's actually very important. Why is that such a surprise?" And then I remember being in Poland, sitting around a table with cabinet ministers and being the only woman in the room. I mean, when you work in aerospace and defense, you may go days without seeing anyone of your gender if you're a female, just walking from building to building. They just don't exist. But right. He literally, after I raised an excellent point with all of these senior level cabinet ministers, there was a prime minister in the room, and I made a point, and he said, "That's a pretty good point, especially since you shouldn't even be here because you don't have a penis."
Oh my gosh.
So all of these wow. experiences gave me that drive that you were talking about. The important thing is you don't let it change the essence of who you are. You don't let it make you bitter. You don't let it make you angry. You just let the work and success be the best response.
I love that. And there's such an integrity to that, right? To not be emotional and not be, to keep the emotion out of it and to really let the work do the talk. And like, I'm like show versus tell, right? Which is such an important leadership skill that, we learn a lot and we can do a lot more often, even like listening over talking. And so I love that as we think about also just creating spaces where for people to succeed, I think that's such a valuable, important trait. So now you are Chief ESG, Environmental, Social, Governance, and Communications Officer. And so can we, and I know prior to that, I believe you're a CMO of Aflac, but now in this role, for those of us that don't know what ESG is, can you give us sort of the accessible definition of that? And I think what's interesting, speaking to so many corporations every single year, I feel like often it's so siloed, right? Either I'm talking to somebody in comms, corporate affairs, I'm talking to somebody in D&I, and it's, you know, every company has such a different structure. But I've always felt, you know, I've talked about this, where the convergence of all of it, the convergence is at the end of the day, it's about, you know, your workplace has people, internal people, and that you impact, and it has external people that you impact. And really, there has to be such a more integrated strategy, I've always felt, from an external perspective. And as I advise leaders as well, those really innovative companies are really integrating everything. And I think ESG in many ways is the strategy to do that. So would love to, you know, for you to share your explanation and definition of it.
Oh, that's tremendous. Well, ESG stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. And when I talked about curating my career, the governance piece became really super important in a highly regulated industry, because, for example, in insurance, we have a state regulator for every state. So we are beholden, if you will, to 50 state regulators, plus the federal government, plus we're a public company. So we're publicly traded. That means we have SEC rules and regulations and all those sorts of things that we have to follow up on. So that's the G part. S is what is traditionally known as corporate social responsibility, which is my personal passion. And I just feel so fortunate that I'm able to marry my personal passion with my work life. And it's definitely in terms of helping companies to be the best corporate citizens they can be, to fulfill needs that can't be filled elsewhere, whether that's government or nonprofits. I mean, we have a huge responsibility in corporate America to do these things. And I'm just so proud that I work for a company that really values that. Mm-hmm. Of course, environmental is the one that people are most familiar with. And that is about lowering carbon emissions and making sure that we are doing everything we can to be a good corporate citizen when it comes to being stewards of the environment. And I really find it fascinating because there are so many ways you can measure your impact in all of these areas. And as a matter of fact, when we were looking at these standards and these regulations, none of it really is by statute outside of the governance piece. You have accords, you have organizations, you have guidelines, but no one is actually outside of public company governance actually creating standards that everyone has agreed to. A lot of people talk about it. So we chose four standards by which to measure our ESG efforts. And they are the UN Sustainable Development Goals, mm-hmm. the Global Reporting Initiative, TCFD, which is the Task Force on Climate Change Disclosures. I always mess that one up. Mm-hmm. And you see, I got so strong. Oh, SASB, of course, SASB. So those are the four standards we use. And we've been very, very transparent about articulating that. So if you go to a cute little hub that we launched earlier this year called esg.aflac.com, it's a fun interactive site. I think it's fun, but I'm a corporate wonk, so I'll let you judge for yourselves. But it has all of our information in a very transparent way, what our goals are, what we plan to work on, and where we are now in relation to those goals. And I love it because it's the perfect opportunity to be held accountable by all stakeholders because it's so visible and it's so transparent.
Yeah, and I think that that is something we're seeing the great companies do, is the transparency and making those external commitments. And I just Googled also ESG, and I clicked on images, and I see there's always the three circles or the three columns where it sort of tells you the bullet points of what falls under ESG. But so just only because we do so much work here at She Summit around diversity and inclusion and culture, and or folks that there's so many people in this community also that if it's not a paid role, it's a volunteer role or it's a personal passion where they sit on committees and potentially, you know, an ER, an employment resource group or a BRG, or they champion or they chair something. So from the social perspective, and I'm looking at something online that just says, you know, like social is like working conditions, local communities, health and safety, employee relations and diversity. So what do you sort of predict is going to happen in terms of the convergence of it all? Or like, what do you think makes an ideal company structure for all of this to really be successful so that every diversity and, you know, like the ESG, all those things are successful? Just any thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I think for us, and I'm going to use the term DE&I because I think that's most important, falls yes. under the S. Now, responsibility for it may be housed in human resources, but we certainly report on all of that. We're on the Bloomberg Gender Diversity Index. Our workplace population is almost 70% female at Aflac and almost 50% minority. So it is really in our DNA. We've had the same CEO for 30 years. So he definitely got out in front of all of this a long time ago, and it pays dividends, particularly if you look at the success of the company. It's a brilliant case study. I personally believe that without inclusion, you will never have diversity. Because if people don't feel valued, you're just going to cycle through them. It gets really expensive. You're going to hire them and they're going to get frustrated and leave, which is where equity comes into play as well. If you're not paying people equally for the same work, you'll never have diversity. You'll never have a truly diverse culture. And part of inclusion means you really have to appreciate what everybody brings to the table and provide them with a safe space to bring those unique ideas and those unique skills to the table. Lots of times people do one but not the other. And I think you really need both. Definitely. I see a couple of heads shaking, so thanks for the yes. validation.
No, this is great. And so the next question I have is around COVID-19, because I know that's a huge theme that's happening right now. And I think this is where, you know, your values, your ESG values really show up in terms of, you know, we hear the term first responders. And, you know, when I Google it, it's like law enforcement officers, state troopers, deputies, federal agents, school resource, paramedics, et cetera. So corporate first responders, right? Like I was thinking a lot after our last conversation around what Aflac, like the immediate reaction. And I think for the company, a lot of companies I know, like my friends at Morgan Stanley, they have some of the best crisis management people that like work for the Obama administration. And, you know, some companies are really, really set up from a crisis management standpoint versus others that are more reactionary and we're not prepared. But tell us about the corporate response, and also because so many of us are not in the C-suite, and sort of giving us a peek into like what happens and how did Aflac respond when COVID-19 hit so that we can all sort of learn from that experience.
Oh, absolutely. I am so proud of the company's response. I really am. We're in a unique position in that over 75% of our business is in Japan. So we insure 1 in 4 households in Japan. Distribution channels different, product sets different. But they are a very, very important part of our business. What happened was they had a contractor diagnosed with COVID-19 3 weeks before you even heard of a primary diagnosis here in the United States. So we got to follow them stepping back about 3 weeks and see how they handled everything. Culturally, it's very different. So someone tested positive, they issued a press release. Obviously in the United States, you have HIPAA and all these other things that preclude you from doing that. But because they did release something publicly in Japan, we had to file an 8-K here. And that was our first entree into this is going to be big. Within 2 weeks, we had 98% of our workforce working remotely, which is pretty remarkable when you think about call centers and claims processing and all of the operational things that an insurance company has to have. It's not a bunch of IT people who are kind of used to being able to do that. Very much a cultural shift. So that was the first thing we did, was we got people out of the building. And then we focused on three areas with each of our stakeholder groups. This crisis is so unique because it impacts three areas simultaneously. It impacts physical, emotional, and financial well-being. The scale and the speed at which this pandemic has traveled is unprecedented. I know that's a word constantly used, and I wish I could think of another word just to make it more interesting, but that's what it is.
I know, crisis, uncertainty, you know, all of it. I know, we're seeing, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. So we also want to come out of this very much whole. So we had some business as usual stuff that happened. We acquired two companies while we were all out for COVID. So how do you onboard people virtually, give them big virtual hugs? Yes, we love you. We're so happy to have you on board. We're so excited. We're not going to come see you right now, but we're delighted you're here. And working through those processes that are really, really important to get those people engaged, keeping our regular workforce of W-2s engaged, also continuing to pay those who are not able to work remotely. And there is a small percentage of those. So we created pandemic leave for them. We also have 30,000 independent sales agents. Mm-hmm. So they're 1099s in status. Right. And if they're not working, they're not earning, because they're a commission-based independent contractor model, who, by the way, sell in a cluster format at the work site. Which nobody's the work site makes it almost impossible. So we did some things to keep their business going. We set up virtual enrollment centers. We provided them with a lot of electronic online tools to help them. But more importantly, not only did we give them all the information about the government options around loan programs and that sort of thing, the PPP, the other pandemic stuff, we actually created a no interest loan program for our 1099s so that we had skin in the game in helping them be successful. Very generous repayment terms. And this gets really wonky, but whenever you go into something like this, you learn so much. So this is the inch I know about the tax code, is when you loan someone more than $10,000, you have to charge a nominal interest rate. So if someone were to borrow more than $10,000, then there would be a nominal interest rate we would charge them, but we have opted to absorb that interest rate on their behalf to keep them whole. So when we come out of this, and we will, we'll have a very viable workforce. We also looked at our policyholders, of course. I mean, this has been a very people-first approach. And before the emergency orders came out, we instituted grace periods for our policyholders, so their policies wouldn't lapse just because they were unable to pay. And we were able to also pay claims out on their behalf to them during this grace period. And then subsequently, of course, the governments got on board, the state and the local municipalities, and started mandating that sort of thing. But we did it first without anyone asking us, and I'm proud of that. And you don't realize all the stakeholders you have until you send thousands of people home with a computer in a small rural area of Georgia. We actually had to also, one of our key stakeholder groups was our internet service providers here, mm-hmm. because they didn't have the infrastructure to be able to support all of these people working from home all day. So we worked with them to help them build the infrastructure to get us all to great levels of productivity. So we've been working remotely for about 11 and a half weeks now. And it's going very, very well. Our customer service numbers, net promoter scores, all of those things that you would typically track look really, really good.
It's such an incredible story. And you, when we were talking on the phone last, you mentioned too that from a leadership perspective, the sort of, I'm like imagining the FBI, you know, gathering into a room, like, or with like how the senior leaders sort of convene and, you know, like, cause like, these are all the initiatives and the things that were done, but the alignment and, you know, like defining, I think you mentioned like a huge document that you created and like noting every single stakeholder. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, that FBI room or that room where, you know, how does that happen? Cause I know that some of you, like, you know, so just knowing a lot of the folks on the call, they might, you know, they are, you know, report into like very directly into leadership, or they're in leadership, or they're, you know, several levels down. But I think it's just really, it's such a helpful tool, especially as everybody rises in their career, to sort of get that perspective of like, this is some of the stuff that happens in the C-suite when something like that happens.
So you set up a war room and
that's a better word.
you set up, although I like FBI, that's really, really cool. You set up a stakeholder map, and ours happened to be 30 pages and looked like a dreadful piece of wallpaper, all skill-lessly knitted together. And then the care abouts for all of these audiences. Over time, as this progresses and things move and you get past one milestone and into another, the focus of that war room changes. So we went from how do we get thousands of people to work remotely in 2 weeks, to protocols for the essential duty to report people, to now what does return to work look like, and who's coming back, and how, you know, temperature detection, will we have to wear masks? I mean, there are lots of corporate policies that are going to have to be changed. And I think one of the interesting, outstanding questions, because you have to look at this from all sides, is the debate between private information and what a company can ask of you in terms of that private information, and how much do you have to divulge, and what is private versus what is necessary to ensure a safe work environment. And I would love to talk to anyone who feels like they've cracked the code on that, because I think that's going to, the ripple effect of that will go on for years. You know, I'm already seeing commercials for law firms who want to sue companies that don't bring back people in the right way. How protected are you? How protected do you need to be? Will the law catch up? What is that going to look like? These are all what-if scenarios that are highly likely that we're all thinking about now. But I will tell you, from a communication standpoint alone, we keep a grid of every COVID piece of content that we send out. And that bulleted grid right now on just communications is 68 pages long and growing.
Wow.
So tracking and monitoring is huge. And it goes back to your early question, Claudia, you know, what gets measured gets done. You want to hold people accountable for something, put a metric around it.
And so who sits in this war room? Is it like everything from chief people officer, you, it's CEO, it's CEO, it's just like, what are all the divisions that, because I'm just thinking about even all the different, I mean, and every company is different. So just curious, because obviously you have to have all of those perspectives.
It's a cross-functional team. We have a war room by country. And then on Wednesday evenings, we have our global call where everybody goes over their deck, if you will, of what's going on from a geopolitical standpoint in their country, what triggers it will take to bring back people back to work, what is the return to work plan, what are the markets in that particular country look like, what's the impact on our investment strategy, what's the impact on claims, you know, all of these things. How have we modeled this out? We create these models for the investment community, and they're based on the Spanish flu because that was the last pandemic we've had.
Right.
So all of these work streams are taking place simultaneously. So when you come into this war room, basically it's a cross-functional team, and every business unit, every country, and every function is represented. And some, their activities are a little more hot than others, depending on where you are in that crisis cycle. For example, IT was huge at first, right? As you would expect. Yeah. That's rather died down because people are working from home and they're being doing it successfully. So health and wellness is kicked up. HR has kicked up quite a bit. You know, you have natural attrition. How do you hire in this environment when you can't send somebody to a lab for a drug test? You know, you can't, you know, there are lots and lots of logistical things. And so we have teams working constantly on these things, not to mention all of the programs we've put in place for our own employees, which I mentioned earlier. And there's another work stream that's just looking at our policies right now, yeah, trying to figure out what, how can we pay as much as we possibly can on these policies? Mm-hmm. Because these are legal contracts. So in a regulated industry, I may want to pay you under a certain policy, but that is not covered in the policy. So if I overpay you or underpay you, mm-hmm, I get audited and fined by the government regulator. And I don't think people realize that.
Yeah.
So what we've done is if there is something where we see a need, early on, it was personal protective gear, personal protection gear. So we donated $5 million to organizations that help do that in the U.S., that help manufacture it and then distribute it. We are getting a lot of calls in our call center about mental health needs of frontline responders. Mm-hmm. So we just donated, just this past week, $1 million to the crisis text line. Because their volume of calls in terms of mental health needs for frontline workers has also increased. Mm-hmm. So again, continuing to do this in a very important way. Most important thing for companies right now is don't be tone deaf. You know, don't be foolish about it. Do the right thing by everybody and regardless of how you come out of this, because we will. This will end and we'll come out of it. And we'll be better and stronger. And I think the companies that do the right thing by their employees first and their community second will fare the best.
People first, community second. And actually that is a perfect segue. And by the way, the CEO donated $1 million of his personal money as well, correct? Remind me what cause?
He did. It's a local hospital here, so that they basically, he did a challenge grant for $1 million, and he was able to fund the opening of an entire floor of a hospital that included an ICU unit. Incredible. And the rest of the floor just to handle COVID cases.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible. And I think, you know, back to what you were saying, people first and then community right after that, I think of the internal and the external. And as the next question is really around communications and how, and I think everybody touches communications to some degree in our roles, because there's the internal communications portion and then there's the external piece. And it sounds like, I mean, when I think ESG and I think communications officer, I think a very external role, but it sounds like it's been priority. It's got to be priority inside first, right? Inside and then outside. Or finding that balance is not easy. So can you just tell us sort of, the sort of what you believe or how you believe the communications role, like, because we, you know, I think for many of us, we just think, oh, like they're in charge of communications and corporate PR and, you know, but really how profoundly that role is changing and how critical it is from an inside and outside perspective.
I think the internal comms piece has accelerated exponentially during this crisis, and the value and the perceived value has gone up tremendously. What I find is in a corporate communications team, usually your external communicators are about a level ahead of their counterparts on the internal communication side. What does that mean? If you have a head of corp comm that's a VP or a head of PR that's a VP, your head of internal comms might be a director. Mm. It's considered a little more junior,
yeah,
than
less valuable, almost, if you in a way.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should say it that way, but I think this has been an opportunity for internal comms teams to absolutely shine, to absolutely prove their value to the C-suite in a way that they've never been able to do so before. So I think we're going to see some shifting there, and I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
You know, we can really, we reap what we sow and really set the foundations. Like, how do we learn from this and really build, you know, this people first, people then community, business, and this model of working. And I love that. So thank you so much for this amazing conversation and your time. And any final messages before I close with the audience?
Okay. Four quick things. No one will ever give you a seat at the table. You have to earn it. And if there's not a seat at the table, walk out the door, pick up the closest folding chair you have, storm back in and sit down. Take your seat at the table. Be fearless, not foolish. When you take a risk, make sure it's a calculated risk and you've thought of all contingencies. Prioritize what's important, because oftentimes the urgent overcomes the important. And always keep the end in mind. What's the result you want and gear toward that?
Thank you so, so much. I love those takeaways. And we'll also recap that too in our notes. So I want to just share a message with everybody that this is our last community call that we're doing a part of this sort of free series through April and May. But you will all hear from us in about a week or so around our new announcement and the new She Summit virtual online membership. That's going to offer monthly coaching from our incredible award-winning speakers and celebrated speakers like Catherine and community. We're going to open up a LinkedIn and new community space for everybody, as well as, of course, our ninth annual summit. But so thank you so much, everybody. And thank you, Catherine, for your time and your partnership. And we have to collaborate to accelerate. And I always think it's that external company with the external change agents and the corporate change agents, like together we can change the world. So thank you for speaking into all of us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining so much. I'm so grateful for your community and your connection.